Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Now available online through Larder Meat Company. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
Good evening and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food systems and policy and how they impact all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting on Heritage Radio Network. Today, I'm so excited to welcome author Carrie Gillam back to the show. I had the pleasure of interviewing Carrie in 2019 about her award-winning book, Whitewash, which is an astounding expose on Monsanto and the health risks of its best-selling herbicide, Roundup. In this episode, we will be discussing Carrie's new book, The Monsanto Papers, Deadly Secrets, Corporate Corruption, and One Man's Search for Justice, which offers a rare inside look at a landmark lawsuit against Monsanto, pulling back the curtain on the grueling legal battle, the frailties of the American court system, and the extent to which the company was willing to go to hide the dangers and dire consequences of its products. Carrie, thank you so much for being here today. So first of all, I want to congratulate you on finishing this new book. And I want to just see if you can provide some more background on how you started reporting on Monsanto in the first place and what you covered in your previous book.
Sure. So I, you know, was assigned by Reuters, international news agency, was where I spent a good deal of my career, 17 years. And I was assigned in 1998 to start covering this very big company, very big and interesting company called Monsanto, because they had introduced genetically engineered crops in the 1990s. And it was revolutionizing agriculture and the way, you know, farmers, what they grew, how they grew it, the chemicals that they used. And competitors were jumping in, and it was a very big change for agriculture overall. So that was my job, to learn and write about those companies and the business. And, you know, it just sort of all evolved into my first book, which was called Whitewash, which came out in 2017. And that was really the culmination of 20 years of research into the health impacts and the environmental impacts of this weed killer sold by Monsanto. Most people know it as Roundup. The active ingredient is glyphosate, a chemical called glyphosate. So, you know, the first book was really sort of an academic, I guess I might say, book filled with a lot of science. This book is an extension of that, but this is a personal story of one man who was exposed through a couple of accidents to very large quantities of this weed killer Roundup and developed a really awful terminal cancer, and his struggle with that and what he learned about what Monsanto had hidden about Roundup and glyphosate, and how he and a group of really sort of interesting, eclectic lawyers got together and took Monsanto to court. First time in the world to bring Monsanto to trial over allegations that its Roundup weed killer causes cancer.
Okay. And so let's, can you provide some background on Monsanto? I think probably most of my listeners are very familiar with their work, but if, for any new listeners we have, how big is the company in terms of revenue and what, you know, what is the range of products that they make and where are they now?
Well, Monsanto actually is, no more. There is no more Monsanto, existing as a separate standalone company. It was bought by the German conglomerate Bayer AG. Most people know Bayer by Bayer Aspirin, you know, the big pharmaceutical company. And they were bought by Bayer in 2018, and the Monsanto name has effectively been retired. But before they were bought by Bayer, you know, they'd been around since the early 1900s and been involved over the years in an array of sort of industrial chemicals. They were involved in DDT. They were involved in the production of Agent Orange. They were involved in PCBs and had a lot of sort of environmental woes attached to many of their products. And in 1974 is when they introduced glyphosate and Roundup, and their weed killing products became incredibly popular and became the most widely widely used weed killers in the world. And then, of course, they were known more recently for their genetically engineered crop technology
that could specifically withstand, you know, developed specifically to withstand the spraying of their products.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Roundup ready crops.
all really good things they've been associated with, solid, healthy products over over the years. Wow. Okay. And it's, you know, big business, right? Sold for an enormous amount of money to Bayer over asking price. How big, you know, how much revenue do they generate, and how important is the glyphosate product line to their business?
Well, so Monsanto, you know, ranged, you know, it changed year to year, but ranged 13, 14, 15 billion in revenue every year. Bayer paid about $63 billion to buy Monsanto in 2018, which turned out not to be such a good deal for them. It's been deemed by various news outlets as the worst corporate acquisition, you know, in history.
Has it really? I didn't know that. I mean, I'm not surprised, and we'll get into why, but I did not know that. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll talk about that in a minute.
But. Okay. Yeah. But no, in terms of the revenue breakdown, so glyphosate and their weed killing products, the company didn't break out specific profit and revenue, but they did break it out for the unit that contained their agrochemicals and their inputs. And that was about, $3, $4, $5 billion, say, out of their $15 billion. And the crop technology, the seeds, really became sort of the mainstay for Monsanto and for its profits and revenues. But you have to take into account what we said earlier, which is that a lot of the crop technology was tied very directly to glyphosate. So if you don't have glyphosate on the market, if you don't have Roundup, Roundup ready seeds are useless. So the seeds and the chemicals were very much connected for Monsanto's wealth and well-being.
Mm-hmm. And what is the difference really between glyphosate, Roundup, and Ranger Pro, which is a product kind of featured in this litigation? How and why are they used, and typically by whom?
Yeah, so, I mean, they're all very similar. They're all sort of the same. Glyphosate is the active ingredient. Mm-hmm. It's the weed-killing chemical that makes it work. Ranger Pro is a more, you know, concentrated, toxic sort of chemical that can be used by, you know, landscapers and groundskeepers, such as the gentleman I write about in my book, Lee Johnson. He was using Ranger Pro. But they all, in effect, are based around this chemical glyphosate.
But they're different versions of a similar product that have a lot of different ingredients in it.
Yes. I mean, I looked through a list of the brand names not too long ago. I mean, there are so many. I mean, there's just far more than I thought. I mean, worldwide, there are over 700 products containing glyphosate that are weed killing products that are sold. They contain different things, different surfactants, different percentages, you know, of dilution materials, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're aimed at different markets, different geographies. Most, you know, residential users probably are just familiar with that bottle of Roundup that they pick up at Home Depot or a Lowe's or a Walmart and, you know, walk around in their garden and spray weeds.
Yeah, that's terrifying, I think. I think that this was a kind of comes up in the research, though, the difference between just the active ingredient and the active ingredient when combined with other ingredients, you know, in certain products.
Yes, I mean, the formulations very definitely have been found by scientific researchers to be more toxic, more dangerous to human health, if you're going to look at it that way. Yeah. For a long time, Monsanto was using a particular surfactant that we refer to as POEA that was found to be so dangerous that it was banned in Europe. So, you know, that was one thing that was considered inert, that wasn't, was considered something that didn't need a lot of attention and was being mixed in with glyphosate and, you know, for a very long time.
Okay, so this book is the inside story of Lee Johnson's landmark lawsuit against Monsanto. Who is Lee Johnson and what is his story?
So Lee Johnson is just a regular guy. You know, he's a guy that had a really hard time growing up, kind of, you know, got into some trouble with the law, had a hard time in school, you know, became a father very, very young, didn't have his own father around as he grew up. His mother was absent a lot of the time as well. He really struggled, but then seemed to find himself as he moved into middle age. His father of two young boys then, and got married and found a great job working as a school, you know, groundskeeper, basically taking care of all of the schoolyards for this large school district in Benicia, California. I loved the work, and it was getting, you know, a lot of praise from supervisors and making a decent income, and really just felt really good about his life. Then he had this accident where he was doused with Monsanto's Ranger Pro, you know, just soaked to the skin. And then when a tank on the back of the truck that was filled with this chemical, the hose came off and it sprayed this giant fountain, and he was in there trying to, you know, clog it up and shut it down. And anyway, he comes to find out, you know, not too long later, about a year later, his skin starts erupting in these strange lesions. And over time, you know, he's told it's skin cancer, and then it's a more deadly kind of cancer, and then it transforms, and he's told he has 18 months left to live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his health battles were pretty harrowing to read about. It's not just, you know, skin cancer. It is just like, you know, your description of the sores and like the excruciating pain he was in. I had no idea that was a symptom.
It was so brutal, and I still don't even know if I really conveyed, you know, the level of suffering that he has been through. But to see the wounds, the lesions, the scars, the scabs, the blood, the skin, you know, that's just a part of his everyday life as his entire body is covered with these cancerous lesions. And it's so painful for him to move, to wear clothes, you know, to put socks on, to, it's just a brutal cancer that, you know, has come for him.
And that's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma it's a specific kind of that cancer though, right?
It's a specific kind of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Yes. That manifests on the skin and the tissues of the skin.
And it came about, so he had this like kind of harrowing accident where he was just like, even though he was wearing PPE at the time, but he was just so soaked accidentally that it just got all over him, right?
Yeah, he had a lot of protective gear on, but when he dove into the back of this pickup truck and there's this fountain of weed killer, you know, spraying up into the air, and he's trying desperately to shut off the you know, valve to shut it down, you know, it just got all in the suit and down his neck and soaked his clothes underneath. And the thing was, he had always been told that it was so safe. Mm-hmm. And that you really shouldn't need to worry about it too much if you did get some on your skin. So he didn't rush right back to work. He stayed and cleaned up the mess. He didn't rush home to shower. He just went on about, you know, his business, to do his job, and didn't shower until that evening when he got home.
And worth reiterating that this was at a school. He was spraying the school grounds, and this was like a fountain of chemicals just kind of being release that he was trying to clean up really quickly.
Yeah, he was trying. It was running at this area right by the school. There's a large body of water right across from it, and there's a, you know, it runs down into that. And he was trying to keep it from getting into the waterway because he knew that would be bad in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So how did this case unfold? You know, who became part of the legal team? How did they come to work together? And was this just Lee's lawsuit, or You know, was this a representation of many, many, many lawsuits being filed?
Right. So what triggered all this litigation was the International Agency for Research on Cancer in 2015 examining the literature on this chemical glyphosate and looking at Roundup and looking at glyphosate and all these studies that have been done by independent researchers for many years. And they determined it was a probable human carcinogen with a particular association to non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Well, when they did that in March of 2015, plaintiffs' lawyers in the United States immediately recognized this as, you know, ripe for litigation because it was so widely used, because it was such a popular product, because non-Hodgkin lymphoma, you know, affects so many people and can be so deadly. So they started advertising. Lee was one of tens of thousands or now more than 100,000 people who have brought claims.
Wow.
Against
wow.
Monsanto, alleging their non-Hodgkin lymphoma is associated to their exposures, right, to Roundup. Mm-hmm. So he was only one of many, and there were many lawyers working on this, but his case rose through the ranks to become the first simply because he was expected to die so quickly.
And is that how he was chosen, you know, out of all of the possible plaintiffs, his case was like the most terminal and the most imminent?
It was a combination of the fact that he was expected to die so quickly and the fact that he had signed up with one of the leading law firms, the law firm that had been on this litigation since the beginning and had already gone through quite a bit of discovery and had put a lot of their case together. They just weren't sure who would be the first plaintiff among their thousands of clients. And so when Lee's lawyer realized that he was expected to die within, you know, 18 months or so, they knew they had to get him to trial quickly. And they asked the judge for what was called a preference trial. Mm-hmm. And Monsanto opposed that, did not want him to have the ability to go to trial quickly. But the judge essentially overruled them. And the trial began in June of 2018.
What makes this case similar or different to other, was this considered a mass tort litigation case?
Yes, this is mass tort. This is when you have large numbers of people who allege injury, you know, associated with one company and one product. It's different from a class action. These people, their injuries are different. Their circumstances are different. You know, their exposures would have been different. So it's mass tort. They're all handled individually, but they can be combined for things like discovery and, you know, sort of some early decisions by judges.
And that happened in this case early on as well, right?
Yeah. There were a lot of twists and turns and a lot of just really interesting things that I learned about, you know, how strategic you get when you're putting these cases together. And this was how they did it. I watched how the sausage was made, so to speak, bringing big cases to trial and trying to hold big companies to account. It was really fascinating to watch it.
Well, I was very captured by the entire process as well and read every last page of this book. It really laid out the complexities of the case and the court system in a compelling and easy to understand way. And one of the things that struck me when I was reading this is that the judge wasn't originally as friendly to the plaintiff's case, in my opinion. Like, the burden of proof was very much on the prosecution to demonstrate how egregious Monsanto's actions were.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. You see it evolve. You see the judge's attitude evolve. It was a very high hill to climb. And
yeah.
You watch how they put it together and some of the self-doubt that they go through. I mean, I really tried to tell this book differently than Whitewash. I tried to tell it through the eyes of this small group of attorneys and through Lee and his wife. And so that you're there with them, you know, in the hotel in Chicago when they're, you know, talking about, you know, could we actually win this or not? And they're strategizing. And, you know, one of their witnesses at the very last minute, they're afraid to put her on the stand because they're afraid she's going to say the wrong thing and they don't know what to do. Like, all of that drama I really wanted to bring into the story so that it would be something that would carry readers, you know, all the way to the end.
And I, you know, I wanted, before we kind of wrap up the conversation on mass tort, like what other examples of how litigation of this kind has changed, you know, the way in which we regulate certain products. Can you give us a few examples of how it's been used to kind of protect health and safety through this work, and whether or not this is like the most effective way to do so?
Well, you know, if you look at opioid litigation, for instance, you know, or the Takata airbag litigation, or gosh, or, you know, tobacco litigation.
Right.
We can go on and on and on, right? Or the PFAS litigation, DuPont poisoning the water, you know, in West Virginia. You have time and time again, so many examples, giant companies, very powerful, dangerous product, dangerous medical device, defective product, regulators and lawmakers, for whatever reason, just can't seem to, you know, get the ball rolling or do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And I try to make this clear in my book. I don't advocate necessarily that it's a perfect system, this mass tort, this plaintiff's bar. But it's all we've got right now.
Right. Yeah.
Our regulators are not protecting people. And these law firms are the only ones out there hauling these companies into court, putting forth the evidence, putting forth the science, and saying, you've, you know, been lying to us, or you've been negligent, or you have not, you know, followed the law. And, you know, it's unfortunate that we have to rely on these law firms to do what should be done by our regulators.
So at the end of the day, what was this lawsuit really about? In the trial section of the book, you kind of outline, you know, in the opening arguments, the two sides kind of conclude and tell the jury that the case is really about differing questions. What are those questions that each side sought to answer through the trial?
Well, I think the easiest way to think about it is sort of there were two elements to this. I mean, there were many more, but it can go into two buckets. So you have the science. You know, what does the science say about these chemicals? Roundup, glyphosate, you know, in these products, the chemical. What does the science say about its association to cancer, and specifically non-Hodgkin lymphoma? And then, of course, as part of that, what is the likelihood, or, you know, the basis for understanding that Lee Johnson himself, you know, that this particular chemical caused his particular cancer? That is all sort of in one bucket. It's the science, it's the medicine, it's the research, it's the hard evidence related to that chemical. Then you get into the separate bucket, which is conduct, which is the company conduct. And there was a whole realm of evidence to show that Monsanto engaged in what the lawyers alleged was, you know, misconduct, that they tried to manipulate the scientific research about this chemical, that they hired third parties to try to smear the reputations of independent scientists who were warning about this chemical, that they, you know, engaged in ghostwriting to try to make it look as though independent scientists were saying that its product was safe, when in fact those papers were written by Monsanto scientists. Mm-hmm. That they colluded with individuals inside the Environmental Protection Agency to quash reviews of the toxicity of glyphosate. You know, it went on and on and on in terms of what they alleged was misconduct, and the jurors agreed with them, which is why they found in Lee's case that they said he was due $250 million in punitive damages alone. Mm-hmm. Because Monsanto's conduct was so egregious.
I also thought it was really clever how Brent Wisner, the man who ended up through a series of unbelievable events becoming Johnson's lead counsel, how he framed the question in his opening argument. He said that this case is about choice. It's about the right for every person to make a personal decision for themselves about what chemicals they want to expose themselves and their children to. Some people, of course, are willing to take greater risks, but the potential dangers, like a clear association between a product and a very specific form of cancer, need to be made obvious so that consumers can make their own decisions. It's about how, you know, he was clear that they're not trying to ban glyphosate that products like tobacco, which are very harmful to your health, are still in the market. That's not what they were seeking to do. They were seeking to talk about how, at the very least, these products should have come with a warning label or like, you know, more a clearer warning of their potential toxicity.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, that was his point. And that's what a lot of the lawyers involved in this have all said, that they're not advocating a ban. They don't want the product off the market. That's not what it's about. It's just simply about being honest and giving consumers, you know, factual information about the risks that they face when they use a particular product. And, you know, they had some internal documents from Monsanto where you see the company telling its own employees to, you know, take care and be sure you wear protective gear and long sleeves and, you know, pants and gloves, et cetera, et cetera. But then at the same time, advertising its products to consumers with commercials showing people, you know, in flip-flops and shorts and short sleeves spraying this, you know, with no protective gear on at all. So, you know, and all of this notion about how safe it is. And there are documents, you know, from the EPA dating back to, you know, the 1970s and 80s, where you see EPA officials, scientists trying to tell the company, hey, we think that you should put a warning label on your product and it should say danger and it should say certain things. And Monsanto is absolutely refusing to do it because their chief selling point for this product for 40 some years now has been how safe it is. And they do not want anything on there to detract from that.
So there's no warning label on the products. I mean, with Ranger Pro, I thought that they had to, you know, groundskeepers had to use PPE to use
it. Oh, sure. No, there's all sorts of warning labels. It doesn't warn of cancer. You know, it warns of, you know, eye irritation. You know, if you get it in your eyes, you could, you know, that sort of thing.
Oh God, I can't even imagine what happens if you get it in your eyes. Okay, so what key pieces, you mentioned the EPA, what key pieces of research that did each side look at? You talked about the International Agency for Research on Cancer. Let's actually start there. So they deemed in 2015 that glyphosate, not even glyphosate plus other chemicals, was a possible carcinogen. What does this really mean? And what other products are in this category? Like, why was this such a big deal?
So they deemed it a probable human carcinogen. Okay. Yeah, not a possible. I mean, that was another category, a little bit, you know, lower of a risk that they could have, but they deemed it a probable human carcinogen. And that was based on, as we said, you know, a lot of different epidemiology studies. Now the epidemiology, of course, is not with glyphosate. Epidemiology is real world use, you know, looking at farmers and others who are using the product and in their, you know, normal activities. So that is not glyphosate by itself. Those are formulated products. But then the laboratory studies on animals, they looked at those toxicology studies on rats and mice. There were studies looking at DNA changes in people who lived in areas where there was aerial spraying of glyphosate products. And, you know, people who were not in that area and then people who were sprayed, and sort of they could see DNA changes. And then there were like in vivo studies, which are, you know, like in a laboratory in a test tube sort of a thing, or a petri dish. So they looked at all of those different studies, and that's how they came to this conclusion that it was a probable human carcinogen. They didn't go as far as saying, you know, locked in, we know for sure. And it's interesting to know that IARC, I mean, I have to look again at the most latest numbers, but they typically don't find things to be carcinogenic or probably carcinogenic. They mostly find things that they either say, we don't know, you know, we can't classify it as that, or, you know, possibly, not likely, you know, this sort of thing. But for them to say it's probably a human carcinogen was a pretty big deal.
And to clarify, this organization doesn't conduct its own new studies. They review the existing literature on the subject from a wide range of sources.
Right. They do not do their own research. They look
at their own like studies. You know, they don't start new studies.
No, they do. Okay. They do reviews of published peer-reviewed literature. They will sometimes look at things that are not published or peer-reviewed if they can have the actual data. You know, if the companies usually, their research that they give to regulators is not usually published and peer-reviewed. It's usually considered confidential and trade secret and that sort of thing. So that's a big difference between what regulators look at, which is primarily company data, and what the international agency looks at, which is primarily independent data.
So the EPA looks at what the company gives them.
Primarily what the company gives them.
I mean, I just don't understand.
Which just seems like a really bad idea, doesn't
yeah,
it? But if you think about it, I mean, there's a really good explanation for that, I suppose. I mean, when a company's trying to register a product and they want to sell it, you know, in the US, you know, who else is going to be doing all the studies that are required to get that approval from the EPA other than the company wanting to sell it, you know?
Right.
So they invest millions of dollars in doing research to show to the EPA, hey, this meets, you know, these requirements. So it makes sense from that standpoint, but then you look at it and you say, oh my gosh, they're relying on, because if you do the analysis, and people have done this, invariably, you know, the company studies pretty much always go, oh yeah, my product is really, really safe.
Yeah, of course.
But when independent researchers look at it, it's not really that, you know, clear. It's usually the opposite, at least with respect to Monsanto and glyphosate. So,
and in fact, that was, you know, there was a big point of the case was that Monsanto went to extraordinary lengths to be very influential in the studies that they put forward and, of course, put before the EPA, but just kind of tried to manipulate the science both maybe internally and also when working with external kind of scientists. Because they tried to, I mean, they allegedly had independent third-party reviewers, right, of their science?
Yeah. So what they, you know, one of the emails that, you know, was such a big deal that came out was this email that had been written by Bill Hayden's longtime Monsanto scientist, where he's talking about ghostwriting and he's, you know, sort of explaining it in the email, you know, where, you know, we pay outside authors, you know, to sign their names, but we do the editing. You know, we do the work and they sign their names and we pay them money. And, you know, that's ghostwriting. And he sort of lays all this out in an email because they're planning to do it again. This is after this international agency for research on cancer classification. They wanted to ghostwrite a series of papers to be published to say that these international cancer scientists were dead wrong. And so he in this email is referencing back to another sort of really big paper that they had ghostwritten that they had given to the EPA.
Okay. So that seems unethical.
It's interesting. I mean, you see it in the book in when he's being deposed by one of these lawyers and the lawyer is quizzing him about this email, you know, and about ghostwriting and really just putting the screws to him about, you know, well, you said this, how are you going to dance around that? And, and you see him dance and it's really interesting.
Okay. We're going to take a break to hear a word from our sponsors, but we will be right back. So stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. The Hearst family has raised cattle on California's Central Coast since 1865. Today, Hearst Ranch's signature product is their 100% grass-fed, completely hormone and antibiotic-free beef. The Hearst Ranches have always treated their animals with great care. Their cattle live a completely natural existence as foragers and grazers. Well-managed grazing fertilizes the land naturally, sustains a seasonal rhythm to the ranches, and produces a remarkable meat whose flavor is the authentic taste of the American West. Hearst Ranch beef is available seasonally, May through August, in select Whole Food markets throughout California, and all year round at their retail locations in San Simeon and Paso Robles. And now, HRN listeners in Arizona, Nevada, and California can get Hearst Ranch beef delivered right to their door through Larder Meat Company. Go to lardermeatco.com and shop the 100% grass-fed box to stock your freezer with Hearst Ranch beef. That's LARDER, meatco.com. Learn more about the storied history, farming practices, and conservation efforts of Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with author Carrie Gillum about her new book, The Monsanto Papers, published by Island Press and available now.
Did anything ever come with these people, these internal Monsanto employees, were any of them kind of held personally accountable for their role in kind of covering up or manipulating the science over the past 40 years?
No, I mean, you know, the executives at Monsanto walked away with millions of dollars in their pockets and handed the company off to Bayer, as I said, right when Lee Johnson's trial started. And, you know, they made out quite well. Now, Bayer, when the verdict came down in the Lee Johnson trial after 6 weeks of evidence and people from around the world had been watching, the Bayer saw its stock price plummet. The investors were furious. The investors have sued Bayer management now. They've tried to get the head of Bayer thrown out of his position. You know, it's just really roiled the company substantially, this ill-advised Monsanto purchase.
Yeah. I kind of expressed some surprise at the beginning of the episode that this was such a bad deal for Bayer, because I, at the time, I was actually working for two former investment bankers who specialized in M&A. And their take was like, no, Bayer would have absolutely assessed the risk of this. I mean, this is a lawsuit that was pending and they could just spin out the company and kind of like write it off basically. Like there were definite corporate, you know, ways of managing a situation like this. And of course, I'm sure it was not the first time Monsanto or even Bayer had been sued in this type of litigation. So I'm kind of surprised that it turned out to be such a bad deal for Bayer.
Well, they were very surprised too. You know, they talked about as it all sort of started falling apart and they saw their market cap, you know, just crushed.
Yeah.
There's a lot of explaining to do. And they talked about that, well, they had expected, you know, there was some liability associated with this litigation and they had, you know, thought they might have to pay out some millions of dollars. But they had not anticipated the level of loss and liability that, you know, was just coming at them like a freight train with this Monsanto mass tort litigation. And, you know, the Lee Johnson trial was one thing. It was the first. They appealed. They said they'd win the appeal. They didn't. They appealed again. They didn't win again. There were two more trials. Each trial they lost. The last trial, the third of three that's been held, the jurors awarded $2 billion in punitive damages because the science and the company conduct was just so outrageous to them. So
yeah,
Bayer decided no more trials and they have been working on a settlement and they are still sort of trying to muddle their way through the settlement. But basically it's looking like $11 billion paid out for this first wave of the mass tort cases that are filed, and they've proposed another $2 billion to try to head off some future cases. And this is only in the U.S. There are cases in Australia. There's a class action filed in Australia as well. So, you know, this is a much bigger problem than they anticipated.
Wow. I'm just so surprised at like the hubris, I guess. If you can call it that, that they just did not expect this to be that big of a deal at the end of the day. What was the most egregious finding unearthed in this process, in your opinion?
Oh my, you know, I have to figure out an answer to that because I'm always asked it and I don't think it's any one thing. I mean, I don't know. I think it's cumulative, right? Mm-hmm. It's that they didn't just talk about ghostwriting one paper. You know, the evidence shows multiple incidents of this and how cavalierly they talk about it and just expect it that, you know, it's fine and this is what we'll do. And the evidence that came out showing them, you know, with a fusion center set up to manipulate sort of public opinion, you know, and to discredit people and make it look like it didn't come from them, like it came from some third parties, and to get, you know, articles written by a PR firm that they paid, but make it look like they came from, you know, scientists or, you know, legitimate independent individuals, and have those letters and articles, you know, printed in magazines and newspapers around the country. I mean, it just went on and on and on. Manipulate websites, you know, have things put on WebMD, you know, engineer search engine optimization for Google, for if you're searching for something, you make sure you get what they want you to read as opposed to something else. I mean, the level of manipulation of public knowledge and scientific research was astounding, just astounding.
I think, I mean, that maybe I'm a cynic, because that to me, you know, I was like, I wasn't as necessarily surprised by. It's absolutely unethical and egregious and horrible. But I was like, okay, you know, that's not, I could see how that would be their strategy and how it would be very effective. To me, the thing that stuck out was that, and correct me if I'm wrong on my understanding of this, but they didn't really test over the past 40 years, like whether or not their products, their formulated products, could be carcinogenic.
Well, you know, maybe that's the best answer. You're right. I mean, they didn't do these tests.
Like they just didn't do the tests. Like I can't wrap my head around that.
No one was requiring them to do the tests. You know, no one was. And in 2016, the EPA said in a document that they were actually going to start doing that now. They were going to work with the National Toxicology Program for the U.S., and they were going to pursue some testing of formulated glyphosate products to really try to understand, you know, does it cause oxidative stress? You know, is there a link to cancer? And you can see that Monsanto and CropLife, the lobbying group that Monsanto, you know, contributes to and helps fund, they just went crazy. Then they said to the EPA, basically, how dare you? You know, we do not want you to do that testing. Don't do that testing. And so that is to your point. Not only did they not do testing of their formulated products to, you know, determine if they could cause cancer,
but they suspected it could.
They tried to keep other people from doing it. They tried to keep regulators from doing it. They didn't want that level of scrutiny around their product.
I still really am. I've never really used this word, but gobsmacked comes to mind when I read that. I was like, I just cannot imagine being like in any sort of like product development or management position and being like, nope, we're not going to look into this, even though there had been a lot of evidence over the years that it, in fact, you know, they tried to actively discredit any science that showed that this could be carcinogenic.
And one of the judges in the case made that point to them. And said, look, you know, here you've turned in information. We have this in a deposition that you spent roughly $17 million over maybe 2 years on this project to try to discredit people and create all this fake propaganda. You could have spent that $17 million doing more research into the safety of your product, but yet you chose to spend that money trying to smear and discredit people who were doing research. Mm-hmm. You know, what is that about? So
it's just that's like a smoking gun to me. And then, did I read this correctly again? You know, Monsanto's big. They had this one really big study, this agricultural health survey that, you know, did. It was more of like a longitudinal study on the effects of glyphosate on farmers, right, over decades. Did I get that summary correct?
Sort of.
correct me. Yeah. Help me.
So it's not a study by Monsanto. The agricultural health study is actually not one study. It's actually an umbrella, so to speak, and it's put together by the EPA and, you know, a lot of different, the National Cancer Institute and National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. It's our government essentially saying, hey, we know pesticides that are used on farms are dangerous, or, you know, they're toxic. They're designed to kill things, right? Weeds and bugs and that sort of thing. We want to know what they're doing to people. And so this is from 1993, basically, is when it started. And the idea was to look at farmers, you know, in North Carolina and Iowa, and look at their spouses and their families and see how they were being impacted by all these different types of pesticides that they use. And it's many different researchers, and they do many studies, and, you know, over the course of all of this time, many different things have come out. And one of the things that they looked at, of course, was glyphosate and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And so there have been kind of a couple of updates in the research as part of the agricultural health study. And there was one paper that came out, they referred to it as Andriotti 2018, and it said there was no association between glyphosate use and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And Monsanto has sort of really hung on to that and said, see, you know, here's this study that says there's no association. And so that's the end of the discussion. And then people on the other side have said, well, but here's, you know, 30 other studies that have found an association. So,
not to mention there were serious flaws in the way that study was.
And there are a number of, yes, critics of the mechanisms of that study. It was largely, there was a lot loss of follow-up. You know, it was surveys that farmers would fill out about, you know, their use and their health, and they weren't able to track people over time. And so there was great debate over whether or not that was a very valid study or not.
And that's like the public health, my public health background nerd interest in that, you know, like evaluating the kind of the really hanging on the words of the, how these experts who gave testimony discredited that study. But the one thing that you write, while the AAHS researchers concluded there was no overall association between glyphosate and non-Hodgkin lymphoma, the data did in fact show a significant association with NHL subtype called mycosis T-cell lymphoma. And that's the same type of cancer that was killing Lee. So I was like, did I read that right? Because that was their main, you know, body of evidence that Monsanto pointed to.
Well, there, you know, the science is so nuanced. There's so much that you have to really dig down into, and it, you know, each side tore apart the other side's science. This AHS study in particular was not a very strong, you know, cane for Monsanto to stand on. And obviously the jurors didn't find it to be worthy of their, you know, worthy enough, I guess, to change their verdict. So, you know, yeah, there were a lot of problems with it. They didn't find a direct NHL, but they did find connections to, you know, other type of cancers. So,
right. Like the main type of cancer that was.
But, but as in, you know, I guess what I've learned is a lot of the scientific research that comes out, very rarely do you see a conclusion that says, all right, we've solved it. We've cracked the nut. Here's the end all be all. We now know the answer.
Right.
What you see is, you know, we think more research should be done. This is what we've seen. This is what, you know, the associations that we've made, but more research is needed.
Right.
It's sort of an evolving learning process, I think.
I mean, you can still find scientists and, you know, physicians today, remarkably, that, you know, don't think that tobacco causes cancer, or that, you know, there's a link between sugar and obesity. Or that climate change, you know, you have scientists that say climate change isn't real. So, I mean, I think that to your point, there is always a naysayer. You can always find someone to support your argument. It is really like the body of evidence, the collective.
It's the weight of evidence. And this is what this International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, this is what they tried to do, was do a weight of evidence. You know, what does this tell us? We're not saying for sure. It's not the be all end all of all time. But, you know, it looks to us, the weight of evidence indicates this is a probable human carcinogen. And it's worth noting that one of the scientists on that team worked at the EPA. He was an EPA scientist. So, you know, these weren't some quack people they brought in. They were leaders from around the world, from the EPA and the National Cancer Institute and other academic institutions that came to this conclusion.
So where are we today? The multiple cases are winding their ways through the courts. You mentioned that this is also, you know, happening abroad. Have there been other regulatory agencies abroad that have kind of come out and said, you know, we've seen enough, we want to ban these products or significantly reduce, you know, how widespread they are?
Well, Thailand, I wrote about this for The Guardian. Thailand said that it was going to ban glyphosate along with some other pesticides that, you know, that the science shows are particularly dangerous. And Monsanto, Bayer, CropLife, you know, put the screws on our U.S. government to in turn put the screws on Thailand and to convince them or pressure them not to ban glyphosate. And so Thailand backed away from that. And now Mexico similarly is saying that they want glyphosate banned by 2024. They want it completely out. And they cite, you know, the health of their people. And they desire to have a precautionary principle and to not, you know, endanger their people with this chemical. And again, we have internal documents. I've written about this for The Guardian that show the companies working very, very hard, Bayer and CropLife, to get the U.S. government to convince Mexico to back away from that plan. So we'll see what happens.
Wow. I mean, this is cynical, but like, is it just too late? Is the cat out of the bag? Like, it's just too widespread and too relied upon at this point, in your opinion?
Well, it's definitely too widespread, I guess. I don't think, you know, it serves anybody to say, well, you know what, we're already have such a poisoned environment that let's just keep on poisoning our environment.
I mean, but that's kind of what I think that's like, I feel like that's kind of the mentality of a lot of key players in this space almost. I mean, that you do see people backing away from, like you said, from trying to regulate it further.
Right. Well, it could, you know, that I suppose is a valid thought. And, you know, I do think that there are people, I think that we all have a different urgency around, you know, things that are relevant or important to our own life or our own perspective. And, you know, for my father, for instance, you know, he didn't care much about pesticides, but he was very concerned about, you know, climate change and, mm-hmm. and worked diligently as an activist on that. Now, cancer killed him a few months ago. And I'm pretty convinced it was, you know, this massive exposure that he had to a particular pesticide, not glyphosate. But who knows? But, you know, we can't all fix all the problems in the world. And we just have to do our best to be educated and work to, you know, make a healthier future for our kids, I think. But
yeah,
certainly it's not, the answer is not to say, you know,
Let's just keep
dead in the poison.
No, I think, you know, it's just so widespread. It seems almost, you know, like a losing battle, even if we kind of shut down the production today. I mean, isn't it like in the, don't you write about this in Whitewash, how it's like even in the air or in the rain, it's in like substantial, you know, there's a lot of evidence to show that it's in like a big part of the population's like bloodstreams.
Yes, it's found this particular chemical glyphosate is so ubiquitous in our environment. The U.S. Geological Survey scientists have found it in rainfall samples, in air samples, in waterways. It's found in water, food, found in human urine. Yes, but so are many other chemicals. You know, I mean, this is not a one company, one chemical story. This is a much broader story about we have let, you know, these giant corporations and their profit motivations, you know, become a priority, and public health is taking a back seat. And you're seeing all of these cancers, 40% of men and women is expected to get cancer in their lifetimes in the U.S.,
wow.
Rising rates of cancer in children for some types of cancer, neurodevelopmental problems, declining, fertility, increasing rates of infertility, drops in testosterone levels, reproductive problems. I mean, all of these things that affect our health and our well-being and affect the future for our kids. And, you know, we need to take back, I guess, our health and our lives. And I don't know how we do that best, I guess, but I think education, information, and shining a light like I try to do in my books is, you know, one step anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, it really speaks to the fact that the press, the free press, is truly the fourth estate in this country, which I really respect and appreciate all of your work that has gone into this, and at, you know, some personal cost to you. I mean, my understanding is that Monsanto has targeted you personally over your work on this.
Well, they definitely did. And those are other documents that, that came out, that, you know, we've seen, how they had a spreadsheet to try to, you know, tear down my book, and they paid front groups that, you know, wrote negative articles about me. And, oh, there's other things that have come out that were written. They had some sort of search engine optimization so that if you Googled my name and glyphosate, you'd get, you know, some propaganda they wanted you to read. And
it's truly unbelievable.
Yeah. They've spent a lot of energy trying to discredit and harass and intimidate me.
Well, it means that you're probably definitely onto something. Okay, so we're going to leave it there. But, you know, just one last question. What is next for you? Is this, you know, do you need to take a beat? Or do you think that there's more to the story that will continue to unfold?
Well, clearly there's going to be more because there's still litigation and they still are trying to figure out, you know, what to do about are they going to put a warning label finally on this? Are they not? I mean, there's still more of this story. I'm promising everyone I'm never going to write another book, I think, about Monsanto or glyphosate.
Didn't you say that about After Whitewash? I don't know.
No, I'm moving on to look at some other pesticide issues, I think. But yeah, I do hope people will read this book, though, just if for no other reason to, you know, as a testament to Lee Johnson and sort of the struggle and the torment that he's been through, and, you know, what a remarkable individual he is and how he's touched my heart. And I think he'll touch other people's hearts. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there for today. I want to thank our sponsors. Our show intern is Amber Chong, G. Paul is our engineer, and music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the HRN website or as a podcast wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Eating Matters is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.